There's a curriculum that I know you've experienced here, and I've taught many times in many different congregations, called Building Your Own Theology, an adult education curriculum. I've also done it for teens. There is a particular exercise that's written into this curriculum that asks participants to create a new set of 10 commandments for our modern age. I find the responses to this exercise always very interesting. And they tend to fall into groupings, the three largest of which are protecting and preserving the earth, honoring and caring for children, and loving and caring for oneself. What an idea, that last one. Caring for, even loving, yourself. It is true that self-care and self-love, like caring for the earth and for children, is not in the original Ten Commandments. But unlike loving the earth and children, self-love has a faintly heretical ring to many people. In Western culture, generally, self-love is considered a sin, or in more modern language, a narcissistic obsession, a selfish indulgence, something, in any case, to be avoided. Self-love is under a kind of taboo. So here I am on Mother's Day, of all days, a day on which we honor and celebrate mothers, or those who mothered us, and the kind of embracing selfless love that a mother for her child has, the kind of love that Hallmark card makers love to idealize. But here I am on this day talking about self-love, self-care, about mothering ourselves. Isn't this self-oriented focus the opposite of what I should be talking about on Mother's Day? Well, just consider what this poignant poem called Millie's Mother's Red Dress by Anna Canfield has to say about mothering and self-care. It hung there in the closet while she was dying, Mother's red dress, like a gash in the row of dark old clothes she had worn her life away in. They had called me home, and I knew when I saw her, she wasn't going to last. When I saw the dress, I said, "Why, Mother, how beautiful. I've never seen it on you." "I've never worn it. Sit down, Millie. I'd like to undo a lesson or two before I go, if I can. Now that I'll soon be gone, I can see some things. Oh, I taught you good, but I taught you wrong." "Mother, whatever do you mean?" "Well, I always thought that a good woman never takes her turn, that she's just for doing for somebody else. My life was like that, doing for your dad, doing for the boys, for your sisters, for you." "You did everything that a mother could." "Oh, Millie, Millie, it was no good. For you, for him. Don't you see? I did you the worst of wrongs. I asked nothing for me. I was a free ride for everyone, everywhere. I was the first one up and the last one down, 7 days out of the week. I looked at how some of your brothers treat their wives now, and it makes me sick, because it was me that taught it to them. And they learned. They learned that a woman doesn't even exist except to give. Why, every penny that I could save went for your clothes or your books, even when it wasn't necessary. Can't even remember once when I took myself downtown to buy something beautiful for me. Except last year when I got that red dress. I found I had $20 that wasn't especially spoke for. I was on my way to pay it extra on the washer. But somehow, I came home with this big box. Oh, Millie, I always thought if you take nothing for yourself in this world, you'd have it all in the next somehow. I don't believe that anymore. I think the Lord wants us to have something here and now. It hung there in the closet while she was dying. Mother's red dress, like a gash in the row of dark old clothes she had worn away her life in. Her last words to me were these: "Do me the honor, Millie, of not following in my footsteps. Promise me that." I promised. She caught her breath. Then Mother took her turn in death. This poem illustrates how women in particular have been taught to submerge their own needs while mothering and meeting the needs of everyone else. But this submerging of the self is not confined to women, although traditionally it has been more explicitly expected of women. Back some 30, 35 years ago or so, when I used to teach assertiveness training classes, there was one beginning session exercise which was often very hard for people to do at first. It involved the giving and receiving of compliments. Giving compliments was particularly difficult, but the one on the receiving end was instructed to list his or her accomplishments. So that's the first part of the exercise, asking people to list their accomplishments, to give the compliment giver something to compliment about. And then that person was asked to receive the compliment without deflecting it, shrugging it off, or regarding it, or negating it in any way. And this was what proved to be quite difficult. Actually, giving the compliments wasn't that difficult. It was how to receive them graciously. Most of us have been taught to be humble and to be self-effacing, not to boast, and even to shrug off a genuine compliment for fear that simply acknowledging it betrays too much ego, too much pride, too much self-love. The root of the taboo against self-love and caring for the self goes back at least to the second creation story in Genesis, when Adam and Eve are punished for eating the forbidden fruit and are denounced as evil, willful, sinful creatures, deserving of the harsh punishment that they get. The first creation story from Genesis is very different. Men and women are, in that version, created equal together from the clay of the earth. And there is no moralistic story in that version of disobedience and punishment. But Augustine later emphasized the view of humanity that comes through from the second story, the second creation story in Genesis, that humanity is sinful, willful, and overly prideful. This view reached its full flowering with the Protestant reformers, such as Luther and especially Calvin, who asserted that humans are, as he put it, wholly inclined to evil, and who called self-love a pest. To Calvin, self-love was a form of idolatry, which is contrary to God's law. Centuries after Calvin, Freud supported the idea that self-love is undesirable, not because it is sinful, but because it is narcissistic, It's an infantile turning of the libido toward the self rather than toward others, as it should be for adults, according to Freud. The image of the handsome Narcissus of Greek mythology is conjured up, a cold and hard-hearted youth who spurns love from others and then falls helplessly in love with his own image in a pool of water. Freud believed that one who indulges in self-love becomes like the mythic Narcissus, cold, selfish, and incapable of loving others. But is that really the case? More modern psychologists and therapists like Carl Rogers and Eric Fromm have suggested that it is not self-love, but self-hate, lack of self-esteem, that gets us into emotional and psychological trouble. As Fromm says, love of others and love of ourselves are not alternatives. An attitude of love toward themselves will be found in all those who are capable of loving others. And Fromm refutes the notion that self-love is merely selfishness. Selfishness and self-love, far from being identical, are actually opposites, he says. The selfish person does not love himself or herself too much, but too little. In fact, he hates himself. Millie's mother in the poem tells a hard truth when she says, "Oh, Millie, Millie, it was no good for you, for him. Don't you see? I asked you the worst of wrongs. I asked nothing for me." Being as selfless, as essentially self-negating as the mother in the poem, is not good for either the parent or the child. It teaches not care and concern, but self-neglect. It leaves the parent drained and unfulfilled and creates an unhappiness in the parent that can filter down to the child. It has often been said that you must love yourself to be capable of really loving another. It can also be said that you must have a measure of self-esteem as a parent to foster self-esteem in your child. Low self-esteem can pass like a virus from generation to generation. I remember some years ago, quite a few years now, maybe you remember this, California State Assemblyman John Vasconcellos got some funds for a commission to study self-esteem and come up with concrete ways to enhance it, especially in young at-risk teens. He received a lot of criticism at the time by those who called this effort wasteful and frivolous. But I remember thinking that he was really right on track with this one. It is often out of a lack of self-esteem and self-care that young people turn to drugs, to crime and gangs, which give the illusion of caring. And low self-esteem is frequently responsible for the eating disorders, depression, and suicide that plagues so many teens and young adults. We have all, I'm sure, had our own moments when self-confidence, self-love, and self-esteem are at a low point. When, for instance, we look in the mirror as we age in this youthfulness-adoring culture, and this time we really notice the extra weight, the thinning hair, the sagging skin. We've all had times when we fail to live up to our own expectations, when we fall short in some way and disappoint ourselves, when we feel just plain unlovable. At such times, it is helpful to have the care of someone close, someone to metaphorically kiss us and make it at least a bit better, like the one who mothered us used to do. But it is not always possible to have this kind of caring. And even if we are lucky enough to get such support, it is sometimes not enough. We need to learn how to be our own mothers. We need to learn how to give ourselves the gift of self-care, how to nurture self-love. How can you do this? Well, you know best how you can care for yourself. But here are a few suggestions, things that have worked for me. Once in a while, when you look in that old mirror, look upon yourself not critically, but see yourself as someone who loves you would see you. This does not make you a vain narcissist, unless you get stuck on the self-admiration. But that is not a danger for most of us. Now and then, give yourself a gift of time for yourself and go catch a sunset, put on some music and really listen, or dance to it, or sing to it, sing with it. Cook or buy a dish that perhaps no one else in your household but you likes, or something that you like but don't usually get to enjoy if you live alone, and then enjoy it. Maybe even use your finest china. From time to time, buy yourself a massage or a truffle or a single rose or a whole bouquet. This is a hard one. Become aware of how often you mentally beat yourself up, chastise yourself for saying that stupid thing, or not doing what you think you should have done, or doing what you think you shouldn't have done. And then the next time you catch yourself doing this, stop. Remember to be gentle with yourself, to symbolically cradle yourself, to sing and coo rather than harshly self-critique, to care for yourself as you would a newborn baby. You may want to burn this last one into your brain. Maybe put it on your mirror, your bulletin board, your refrigerator. Remember these words of Sheldon Kopp from his book, If You Meet the Buddha on the Road, Kill Him. Killing anything, dependence on anything outside yourself is what he meant by that harsh title. But this simple statement in his book has gotten me through some tough times. It simply says, learn to forgive yourself again and again and again and again. I close with the poignant words of Rabbi Hillel, a contemporary of Jesus. If I am not for myself, who will be for me? If I am only for myself, then what am I? If not now, when?